Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and I'm just so excited to have you guys with us today. Our guest today is the phenomenal Ed Tsang, and I'm going to give you a little bio info on Ed in just a second. But before I do, I wanted to just say, please bear with me today. For those of you who have been following the Parenting Aces blog, you know today is the day that my son is leaving for his adventure in Spain. And his flight is actually in about 5 hours. So we are in last minute packing mode, errand running mode, and all of that around our house today. My husband even took the day off work so he could help keep things a little calmer in the wake of this upcoming trip. So I'm going to ask all of you to just send a positive thought my son's way as he travels across the ocean to this new adventure, and I have been assured by the director of the Tennis Academy where he's headed that she will recognize him in the airport and will get him safely to where he needs to be, but I'm sure I will be spending a sleepless night waiting for that phone call to come, hopefully somewhere around 2 a.m. once he arrives in Barcelona and then makes his connection onto Mallorca. So just being a little selfish today and asking for some positive thoughts for my son, and if you want to send them my way too, I will take them. All right, that said, let me give you a little bit of information on today's guest. Ed Tsang is an internationally recognized trainer and consultant on peak performance, and he's an award-winning coach, a best-selling author, and keynote speaker. He has spent his life researching solutions to these challenges. He has discovered the secret to the human experience that has nothing to do with strategies, routines, and rituals, and everything to do with the universal power inside each and every one of us. He works in person, by telephone, via Skype, with individuals, with organizations, with teams in the area of peak performance. And he works with everyone from athletes and coaches to salespeople and business teams. And I am just so excited to have Ed on the show today to share with us his thoughts on peak performance and what we as tennis parents can do to help our children perform at their peak. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lisa. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm just, as I told you before we went on air, I mean, the timing could not be better in terms of my own personal need to hear what you have to say today, and I'm really excited to share your work with our listening audience, and I know we all have a lot to learn, and we'll glean some fabulous information from you today. So before I jump in with my questions, did I miss anything in your bio? Is there anything you would like to add to kind of give people a better feel for what it is you do?
Sure. Well, currently, I work with athletes, business leaders, and students from, you know, I've even given lectures to gang members in juvenile detention centers, but I've also worked with world champions, gold medalists, and, you know, CEOs. But, you know, it didn't start that way. You know, towards the end of high school, my father said, "You're going to study computers," because he was in computers and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I said, "Sure, I'll study computers." And went to a school called Rider College, which is Rider University currently. And for 2.5 years, I studied computers, and I liked it, but I didn't love it. And after the 2.5 years, I failed out twice. And coming from a household where getting a B is pretty bad, you can imagine what my parents thought. So I kind of had to do a little soul searching and figure out what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I said I could get a degree somewhere else and just work in corporate America, or I can follow my passion. And something inside me said, if I don't follow my passion, I'm going to regret it one day. And I don't want to have any regrets at the end of my life. So I was teaching tennis at the time just to some neighborhood kids, had no experience, loved the game. And I actually didn't even start playing tennis until the summer after my freshman year of high school. My cousin from L.A. came out and said, let's play tennis. I said, I don't know how to play. Teach me, and I'd be happy to play. And fell in love with the one-on-one aspect because I was a baseball player prior to that. And that summer I played 6 hours a day and, you know, started playing with friends who were in my neighborhood and started beating some of them pretty quickly. So I really fell in love with it. And so after I failed out of college, I said, I want to teach tennis. So I found a couple of the top coaches in the country. Fortunately, they were in the Princeton area where I am. And I said, I want to teach. I have no experience. I'd love to learn from you. I'll teach for free for you guys. And they basically mentored me. And after a few months, they hired me full time. And my parents said, well, that's great that you're doing what you love and making money, but we feel it's important for you to get a degree. And so I found a school in Michigan called Ferris State University, and they have a marketing and professional tennis management program. And the funny thing is, once I got into that program, my grades skyrocketed. You know, I didn't get a brain transplant. I just became into school instead of just in school. You know, if you're in school, you're just enrolled. You know, when you're into school, you're excited about it. So same thing with tennis. I think there's so many tennis players that are in tennis, but the ones who are into tennis are the ones who really excel. So graduated from that program, started teaching tennis, and in 2005 I was named Pro of the Year for the USTA in New Jersey. And I like that story not because I became Pro of the Year, but because I hit bottom and I bounced back, you know. So your bounce back ability is a critical factor in your performance in all areas of life. And then I couldn't go any further at the club I was at, so I started my own company. And once I started my own company, it was kind of my baby, so I decided to put everything into it and specialize in the mental side, which was always intriguing to me, and started writing books and speaking. And, you know, over the past several years, I've connected with, you know, some of the greatest athletes and business minds and students in the world. And now I'm on your show.
That's awesome. I got disconnected for a second, so I don't know if that came through on air, but I'm back.
Okay.
So, got to love the internet. So it's a great story, Ed, and you know, one that I hope our listeners will learn from and, you know, kind of take to heart, because I think that whole message of finding your passion and following your passion, it's a theme that kind of has run through my blog and through my radio shows since I got started, and it's certainly kind of my husband and my parenting style is, you know, helping our children recognize what their passion is and facilitating them being able to follow that. So I love that that's part of your story too.
Yeah, so, and it's funny, I recorded a podcast with Tim Mayotte, former number 7 tennis player in the world, recently, and he told me that, you know, for a while when he was a junior, he kind of resented his father because he pushed him so hard, and he actually got out of tennis for some time. And then it wasn't until he came back to the sport because he wanted to come back and because he really enjoyed it, then he really put in the time and put in the work and became number 7 in the world. So you absolutely have to have the passion for whatever it is you're doing.
For sure. Well, so what do you think is the biggest challenge that our junior tennis players face? Because there, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what's going on in American tennis and how we haven't produced a champion since Andy Roddick, and, you know, what's the problem? So what's going on?
Well, my take is, you know, the first thing is you can't say that juniors aren't working as hard as they did in, you know, the 80s and 90s. not to say that the game hasn't changed. You know, it has changed. So many people say that American players traditionally have just been offensive players, aggressive players, and now the greatest players in the world are able to neutralize and defend better and stay in points longer. But that's not really, you know, my area of expertise. I'm sure that plays a factor, but, you know, for me, anytime someone talks about the state of U.S. tennis, I think about the mental game, because I was giving a workshop a couple years ago at the National Tennis Center to some of the top 10 and unders in the country, and the first thing I noticed was, wow, these guys can hit the ball. But pretty quickly I realized that, wow, when they're not hitting the ball, they fall apart. You know, they're looking in the stands at their parents, they're crying, they're, you know, banging their racket. So I think most players get stuck in feelings. So maybe it's a feeling of discouragement, anger, lack of confidence, negativity. You know, we can go on forever. But people get stuck. And the reason why, well, first of all, 99.9% of tennis players don't know why they get stuck in feelings. They don't know where their feelings come from. They think that it comes from something outside of them, like a line call, or who's watching, or the weather conditions. But it's never any of that. You know, if a line call could truly make you feel angry, then that would mean that every time someone, you know, had a bad line call, then they would get angry. But that's not true. I mean, I'll give you an example. So imagine you're a tennis player and you're in a really low state of mind. You're in a bad mood, you're playing terrible, and you hit a ball, you think it's on the baseline, and your opponent says, out. How do you feel? Frustrated, right? You know, you feel angry. But imagine a different scenario. You're in the zone. You can't miss. The ball looks like a grapefruit. You're feeling great. Your energy's high. And then you hit a ball you think is on the baseline, and your opponent says, out. Do you react the same way? No way.
Yeah.
It's like,
right.
Huh, big deal. You know, it's just one point. Maybe they missed it. Maybe they can't see it. Whatever. So it seems like it's the line call that affects our feelings, but it's not, because from a different state of mind, we see that line call differently. A low state of mind, you know, we're angry. High state of mind, it's not a big deal. It happens. So that's just one example. You know, you can look at who's in the crowd. You can see your coach or your parents in the crowd and think, oh, gosh, I hate when they watch, you know, and then your game falls apart. You know, you're focused on them, you're playing tight, your feet stop moving, your body language is poor. Or you can see your parents and your coach and say, awesome, you know, this is a good opportunity for me to show them, you know, what I can do. So it's never anything outside of you. It's always what's going on inside of you. It's your thinking that creates your feelings, you know. So those of you that are listening, if you don't get anything, if you don't remember anything from this show, remember this. Your feelings come from your thinking and nowhere else. It's impossible for anything outside of you to affect your feelings. We think and we feel our thinking, and that's our experience, and that also affects our behavior. But it always starts with thought. Does that make sense? We might have lost Lisa for a second there. Well, for those of you that are still listening, well, we have a thought and we feel it, and that's so critical, because then you're driving the bus. You're in power. It's no longer the circumstance or the situation. It's totally coming from you, and it's your choice whether you make a big deal of it or you just let it come and go. Lisa, are you back?
I'm back. I'm so sorry. I don't
okay.
know what
it is. That's
today. I'm glad you recognized I was gone.
I did. I heard crickets, and I said, oh, okay, I can talk a little longer.
Well, then let me ask you this question, because I've read a lot of the articles that you've posted on your website, edsang.com, and for my listeners, we will definitely have a link to Ed's site on our links page, and I encourage you definitely to check it out. But One of the things that kind of made me take note and kind of step back for a second is this whole notion of, you know, being able to control our reaction to our thoughts. And it's so funny because one of your articles I actually emailed to my yoga instructor because you and she use the exact same language about thought recognition and giving power to thought and all of that, and it struck me as really interesting. But you know, for kids who aren't self-aware yet, that maybe they don't have the maturity or the life experience to have that self-awareness, I'm just really curious to hear how you help them develop that ability to let the thought come, acknowledge it, and then let it go.
Yeah, that's a great question and a very common one that I get. But here's the secret. You don't need to develop it. We're born with this. You know, the same way that, you know, if we cut ourselves and we start bleeding, we clean it, you know, we put a Band-Aid on it, and it heals itself. Our minds have the same self-correcting mechanism. We naturally gravitate towards clarity and the zone and confidence and motivation, all the stuff that we're looking for. But the challenge for most people is not that they're lacking it, it's that they're blocking it. They're blocking it by continuing to give attention to their thinking. So it's kind of like, the way I see it is, if you're in a low state of mind, it's kind of like you're holding a tennis ball underwater. What do you need to do to have the tennis ball float to the surface? You just let go. It naturally rises to the surface. It's the same thing when you're in a low state of mind and feeling terrible. If you don't make a big deal of your thoughts, if you just realize where your feelings are coming from. See, most people feel nervous because they think it's the tournament or their opponent or who's watching. But the minute you realize that it's impossible for those things to make you feel nervous, feelings of nervousness only come from nervous thinking. That's all that is happening. The minute you realize that, you're back in control because it's coming from you, not from a circumstance or a situation in the world. You know, if you think it's coming from something in the world, you're going to feel that way until that thing changes. Well, good luck with that. So the answer is, you don't need to do anything or develop anything. You just have to understand how this system works. We think, we feel our thoughts, and that's our experience, moment to moment. And as quickly as our thinking changes, our feelings and our experience changes. It's that simple. You know, and so what I tell people is, we may not always know what our thoughts are, because it's kind of like an iceberg, right? You see the tip of the iceberg, but underneath there's most of the mass. A lot of our thinking we don't even realize. But we always know what we're feeling. So our feelings are kind of like our internal GPS. When we're feeling bad, all that's telling us is, we're thinking bad temporarily, and now is not the time to think into our thinking or make big decisions or, you know, talk to someone, you know, about an important issue. When you tune in to your feelings, that'll tell you, if I'm feeling good, oh, okay, I'm thinking good, just keep playing. If I'm feeling bad, that just means, oh, I'm thinking bad, keep playing. You know, so it's really just continuing to play. That's why everyone says, stay present, stay in the moment, play one point at a time. And that's why.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, see, the only, I have people that come to me with issues of lack of confidence, anger, you know, you name it. But the solution's always the same. And there's a lot of sports psychologists and mental conditioning coaches who innocently give strategies and routines and rituals and techniques to players. But the problem is, when someone's in a low state of mind, those routines, techniques, and rituals don't work. You know, that's like if you're playing a tennis match and you're feeling terrible, and then you say, okay, I'm going to take a deep breath, I'm going to tell myself, Ed, you're going to win, you know, it doesn't work because you know you're faking yourself, you know it's not real, so it just makes you frustrated. That's almost like trying to, you know, if you look into a mirror and you try to scare yourself by making a scary face, it doesn't work. I actually tried that once, and I started cracking up. You know, so so I spent my whole life researching the greatest strategies for mental toughness, and what I found is the best strategy is no strategy. It's just understanding how our minds work, and then we know exactly how to perform and behave and what to say. It's that simple.
So when you're working with an athlete, and I'm, you know, I know you work with others than athletes, but for the purposes of Parenting Aces, that's really what we're concerned with. So I'm mm-hmm. going to keep my focus there. So when you're working with an athlete, is your goal then to educate the athlete on how his or her mind works, you know, how the process is structured, so that will in turn lead to understanding and then hopefully into correction of things having gone wonky over the years?
Yep, 100%. You know, for me, it's like a theory class versus an applications class. You know, there's over 400 therapies in psychology in the U.S., and every single one of them is applications-based. So they're trying to change people's thinking or bring them into their past and, you know, make sense of it or reframe. But in what I found is the most effective thing for performance is just understanding how your mind works. Once you understand how your mind works, everything else falls into place.
So interesting. All right, we have a couple
questions. I was just going to say, you know, when we understand how our minds work, we have more clarity, and we don't need to do anything. You know, it's simple, and, you know, people get surprised when I don't give them strategy or techniques, you know, but I can make up a strategy, but, you know, that would be as if I, you know, said, here's a glass of milk. You know, I'm willing to give you the whole cow. I'm willing to teach you how your experience works. And, you know, that's, in my experience, what gets the best results and the most lasting results.
Great. All right, like we have a couple callers on the line, so I'm going to see if they've got questions or if they're just on the line listening. Hang on 1 second.
Okay.
First, we have a caller from area code 208. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Did you have a question for Ed or a comment?
Yeah, Ed, it's been really, really hot out here in the West, and I've had some incredibly long matches, and I've played tough, you know, the first 2.5 hours, and it comes down to a super tiebreaker, and I make one mistake in the tiebreaker and lose the whole match. Mm. You know, what is going on? Do I need a plan B? Because I think I'm mentally strong enough. Mm-hmm. Is it just fatigue? What's happening here?
Well, there's physical fatigue and there's mental fatigue. You know, just the first thing you said, what is your name?
Jake.
So, Jake, you know, the first thing you said was, it's hot out here, you know, I'm having long matches. It's almost like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy for you. It's like, oh, today's hot. Oh, if I play a long match, then I might miss a shot and lose the match. You know, so when you miss that shot late in the match, what goes on in your head? What are some things you say to yourself?
I just have a feeling of dread, like, mm-hmm. oh, my God, what just happened, you know? And mm-hmm. I'm a little surprised that would happen because I'd been so strong up until that point.
Yeah. So what do you think, like that initial thought is, what just happened? Why did that happen? Or, you know,
yeah,
why did I miss that shot?
How did that happen?
Yeah. So here, we'll stop right there because this is pretty important. You have a thought of, oh my gosh, how did that happen? There's nothing wrong with that thought, but if you believe that thought, then you start feeling it, and then you start thinking more. See, when you're, Jake, have you ever played in the zone?
Yeah, I've been there.
So when you're in the zone, are you thinking a lot or thinking almost
not thinking
none
at all?
Yeah. So when you're not in the zone, which when you're tired at the end of a match and you have a thought of, how did that just happen? If you think into that thought, guess what? You start increasing thought and you start thinking more and more, and before you know it, it's like that snowball rolling down the hill. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then that's why you feel discouraged, you feel angry, whatever it may be. But you don't have to make a big deal of that thought. Here's a good metaphor. I live near New York City, and if I'm on the subway platform waiting for the C train, I can't control if the A train comes into the station, the B train comes in, the D comes in, but I can control which train I get on, right?
Yeah.
So our thoughts are the same way. When we're tired at the end of a match, we can't control if a thought comes into our head like, why did that just happen? How does that happen? You know, I thought I was prepared. I stink. Maybe I should try golf. You know, we have all these thoughts that come into our head, and we can't control them. But we can control which thought we believe and give attention to, and then make it grow, and then it overcomes us. It's like getting on the wrong train. It takes us for a ride in the wrong direction. You can just stay on the platform. You can have a thought of, how did that just happen, and just stay in the game and just keep playing. And your thoughts, you're going to have new thoughts that replace that thought. You know, can you remember the last 10 thoughts that you just had right now?
No, I can't.
Don't even try.
I mean,
nobody can.
And
that's how quickly our thoughts happen. They happen so quickly, we can't remember the last 10 we had. So if you know that your feeling of discouragement is only coming from a discouraged thought in the moment, there's nothing to do. Just play the next point, and you're going to have a new thought and a totally new experience. I'll give you a great example. Rafael Nadal was interviewed a couple years ago during the French Open, and he was having some long matches, and, you know, he was tired, but he still won those matches. And so they said, what was your secret? And he said, well, even though I was tired, I realized that I only felt tired when I was thinking that I was tired. So I didn't make a big deal of my thoughts of, I'm tired. I just played the next point, and then the feeling of tiredness came and it went. It wasn't a constant.
That's good.
So it's much better to have your feelings of tiredness come and go at the end of a match versus be a stopper for a play. Does that make sense?
Well, that makes perfect sense. Because I guess...
So,
it's only one thought at a time that we can control, right? I mean, whatever is there is the only thought that we can control at that moment. There's only one.
Well,
we can only do one thought at a time.
Right. You can't even control the thought, but you can only have one thought at a time. And it's always your choice whether you give it attention or you don't. You know, see, when I was younger, I used to think, oh, positive thoughts are better than negative thoughts. But see, the problem with that is when you think of it that way, when you give more value to a positive thought, then when you don't have a positive thought, you're searching for it. And then that takes you out of the present moment. So to me, now it's not even the quality of my thinking. It's just less thinking. The less I think, the more I'm in the moment automatically.
Exactly.
And
boy,
then
that's good.
And then my performance is just great.
Yeah. That's good. I got a match tonight, so I'll be using these. Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling, Jake. Ed, we've got another caller on the line, too. I'm going to just see if they have a question while
okay.
That moved. I have a caller from area code 212. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Do you have a question?
I'm here. Yep. Is that the thing?
Who is this, Bob?
Yeah.
Wow, this is a special treat, Lisa and all the listeners. This is my good friend Bob Ryland. He is one of my heroes. He's a living legend, and he's in New York City. He was the first black professional tennis player, and he was actually Arthur Ashe's hero. When Arthur Ashe was 14, Arthur Ashe said, "I only want to be good enough to be able to beat Bob Ryland," and. And this is Bob. Bob, how you doing, buddy?
I'm still here.
Every time I call Bob, I say, "How you doing, young man?" He says, "I'm still here." Bob, what are you? Bob, are you 93 right now?
Yeah.
93 years young and a living legend. So, Bob, can you? I mean, this let's take advantage of this. So, Bob, can you share with the parents and maybe the players that are listening? Because you were the first black tennis pro, but you also lived through segregation, and you coached Bill Cosby, you coached Barbara Streisand, you coached the Williams sisters. So what have you learned, and what advice can you give to parents and young players?
Well, today, right, the thing is about tennis, it's so hard today. Like the guy was talking about thoughts. The biggest thing, he's got to think about why he's missing this ball, why he missed that ball. And, stay ahead of things. A lot of time, we let things go past us. Like you say, Federer, he's always together, always ahead of things. You see a lot of players out there go crazy. But kids today, it's going to be hard for kids to make it in the pro circuit. Because you take Murray. Murray is the top player, I would say the top player today. He lives in Great Britain. Okay, all the kids there are trying to play tennis, but they don't have the money. See, to be a tennis player, your mother or father got to spend $87,000 to be a tennis player. And you still might make the best thing today, if your kid going to play tennis, get him in college. That's the best thing in the world. Play tennis, you might get a scholarship. Unless somebody, gonna take him out there and pay him the money. See, the Williams sisters was lucky. The Williams sisters got $1 million from Reebok. If it hadn't been for that, that's it. And the kids, today, if they're going to be a tennis player, they got to be in an academy. And it costs so much to go in these academy.
I was talking to Tim Mayotte recently, and he went to Stanford for 3 years, and then he went on the pro tour for don't know 12 years or something like that, and then he went and finished his degree. So he was definitely glad that he went to college, and then he put it on hold and went on the pro tour and had a great career. Now, Bob, I have to ask you this. You used to work with the Williams sisters. Were they talented, or did they just work hard, or both?
No, they had no talent, but the father. You see, the father's a great motivator. Every day, we played from 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 at night. Okay, this is what he said to him. I love your daddy. I mean, love your daughter. And the kids said, I love your daddy. I love you. You kiss him. Give them that confidence, and they've got to love it. So they go to bed with the racket. I'm telling you, this is the only way you can make it. Try to make it, but you have to have that motivation. You got to really dig in. You got to work hard. It's like anything else. You want to be successful, you got to work hard. And if you don't do it, a lot of guys I see are great, but they get up to a certain limitation, and they give up. They could go ahead, but of course, a lot of times, maybe the money will trap in. I had a lot of great players on the road, and what happened, the money gave out. A lot of guys in Brazil and different places became in a bad situation. They'd do anything to make some money. And this tennis today is hard. So if your mother and father have plenty of money and you want to really put them in an academy like Father Terry, which costs quite a bit, that's where you're going to have to go. I mean, tennis is getting big. You know that. You see it every day.
So the parents have to give love and support, but also the children have to love it too. I think that's critical.
Love.
Yeah. So the Williams sisters worked real hard. See, we don't see it. It goes back to the iceberg. We see the success that people get, and that's the tip of the iceberg. But underneath, it's all the hard work that we don't see that they put in. So I'm glad you brought that up, Bob.
Oh, they work hard.
Any other advice you have for players or parents, Bob?
Well, like I said, if the player want to play, he's going to have to really love it. You know, he's going to have to go. I used to go to bed with my racket, you know. Not really. You have to
love it.
You have to love every part of the of what you play.
You don't
want to give up. You want to stay in there, no matter how hard it is. And it's not hard if you love it.
Yeah. When you were in college, Bob, I remember you. I mean, I don't remember you telling me when you were in college because I wasn't alive. But I remember you telling me that when you were in college, you were only allowed to play because there were white boys on the team, and they, you had to stay on the bus, and they got you food, and you had to wait till dark to sneak into the hotel, and you went to a tournament once on your own, and they saw that you were black, and they said, go get lunch. Your opponent's not here yet. And then you came back, and they defaulted you. You know, so you had a lot of bad things happen to you.
Well, see, that's the time
of segregation.
Yeah. That's the time of segregation. When I came up, when I was a kid, 3 years old, I went by the corner to talk to this little kid I played with. And, of course, he's a white kid. And I had a little trowel that I wanted to show it to him. And he said, get off the street. N-word, you know. When I go to school in the morning, I saw a folks drunk up a noose around their neck. Some cousin dragged through the street with a rope around his neck, on a hot, attached to a horse and buggy, Ku Klux Klan right behind him, going up the street to hang him. You see, and he's hollering. So you couldn't do anything. You have to stay in your community. And then sometimes they come in and pick some people out of community because you had nothing to say. No say-so. So integration, you know, came late. I was about 35 years old when I played pro. But, you know, but I had some great players. I had Sal Solomon. I taught him. He was number four. He went up in the French tournament. Leslie Allen was number 17 in the world. I had quite a few players, but to let me down, it was ready to go because the people who had the money died or didn't have them. Like Arthur Ashe. We had a great player who beat McEnroe any time to play in the juniors on film. And what happened, Warren Fell went into the bathroom and was smoking. And what happened, when that happened, I said, I'm sorry, that's it. So he wanted me to help him, but I couldn't help him, because that's the way Arthur Ashe was. He's true to his, whatever he does, a great man. So that's the whole
Bob,
thing.
How did, you know, you lived through segregation. How did you, you know, you're so optimistic. How did you stay so positive?
Well, see, here's the point. We had great clubs. I mean, great clubs. Cosmopolitan, Shady Res. And Shady Res had them. I used to play there all the time. And Shady Res had a big nightclub, all the big band, Duke Ellington used to play there, tennis courts, golf courts. I mean, it was fabulous. And the white people tried to get in, but they couldn't come in. They had to stay outside and listen. So that was the first thing. Like my father, he's white, my mother's black. Okay, what happened there that if he hadn't left Mobile, it would have strung him up because they didn't like that, didn't lie that down. And he had to go to Chicago, marry my mother, and that's what happened there. And I had a twin brother, and my father didn't like white people because his father didn't want to acknowledge him, and he hated all white, yellow people, which I was light, but he loved my brother, and he was black. So that's a reverse situation. So I mean, you mix that, you
but
see both sides.
But how come you have such a great attitude, though?
Well, you develop that. In other words, why get mad? Why get angry? You see, I see so many people die of all that kind of stuff. You know, they get angry. You want to kill each other. So I look at it. I say, man, you know, this is crazy. You know, play tennis. And that's what helped, playing tennis. together all the time, playing tournaments. It's since I was 10, 11 years old, I was playing tournaments. You see, so that, you know, that relieved you from everything. It's like I say, we had great clubs, but now all those clubs, since the integration came, we lost everything. Nice hotels, all this stuff, because we were coming. But it's
I remember. I remember you telling me, you know, things would happen to you, and you just said, well, it is what it is, right?
That's the way it is. You know, you have to look at it. What can you do? Nobody gonna help. See, today, it's so sad that black people can't get together because we have so many different things. Like, I was in Africa. So when I was in Africa, I said, look, I'm from mother country. It's what mother country. See, we sent you over and made money off of you. Give me your shoes. Give me your pants. Send for me. I say, man, what is this? You know, I thought I was a white boy. But I said, you know, I'm Afro-American. Oh, where did I say that from?
Yeah.
Right in Ghana, where the slaves come out of. So you go through a whole lot. But you say, you know, so what? That's the way the world is right now.
That's right. Well,
and
Bob, like, thanks so much for calling.
Okay, buddy. So you take care.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Take care.
It sounds like Bob is a poster child for your whole process. I mean, talk about...
Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of conversations in our time together.
I'll bet. But, I mean, just, you know, the way he is able to take his negative experiences and let go, and as he said, you just keep playing tennis. That's how you deal with it. You just keep playing. I mean, what a phenomenal outlook.
People say don't believe everything you hear. I say don't believe everything you think. You know, and that's just another way to say just keep playing tennis. You know, don't make a big deal of your thinking and just keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely. We have another caller on the line, but I'm going to keep you on hold for a second because I want to give Ed an opportunity to address my next question, which is, what are the biggest challenges that tennis parents face now? Give us some help because we're all suffering here through these challenges, especially as our kids get into adolescence and teen years.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's different. You know, everyone has different challenges. But the nice thing is, what we're talking about, the solution's always the same. So whether your child is going overseas to, you know, train in Spain, or your child hasn't won a match in months, when we realize that every feeling that we have is just coming from a thought, then again, we don't have to make a big deal of that thought. You know, and when we're not thinking a thought, there's no way we can feel it. You know, that's like if when you read a book and then you start thinking, you know, what am I going to have for dinner? You go back to the book and you're like, wait, what did I just read? And you have to read it over again. You know, the book is always there, but you don't have an experience of it because your thinking is elsewhere. So when you're thinking nervous and stressful thoughts, it's impossible to think loving and supportive thoughts and vice versa.
And so how do we change that? And give us some strategies.
I mean, the best strategy for a parent is just to provide love and support. You know, when you see, it's not the words that you say to your child; it's the mindset from which you say those words. You know, you can tell your child, "Oh yeah, you're great. Okay, good luck. You know, you have my love and support." That doesn't mean anything. You know, the words are there, but there's nothing behind it. When you speak from the heart, when you speak from a place of love, then you can't go wrong. And remember how I said we have different states of mind? You know, when we're in a low state of mind, a line call, you know, makes us angry. When we're in a high state of mind, a line call is not a big deal. It's the same thing as a parent. You know, I'm not a tennis parent yet. You know, my daughter's only 5 weeks old, but I'll definitely get her in the game. But I know that when I start parenting her, you know, and start, you know, coaching her, I'm gonna know that when I'm in a low state of mind, that's not the time to talk to her about important things or make important decisions. when I naturally go back up toward the higher state of mind, like that tennis ball rising to the surface, then it's always productive. It's never productive when you're speaking from a low state of mind. Here's a great example. Your son or daughter loses a match at a tournament. You get in the car. What do most people do? Oh, you should have done this. You should have, what's, you know, and parents are in a low state of mind. The child's in a low state of mind. It's never productive. You know, there was a survey of tennis players, and they said, what did you hate most in your career? And they said, when I was a junior training, the car ride home after a tournament.
Yep.
So
I'm actually having that researcher on the show next week. We're going to talk about
Nice. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. But so state of mind is the key. If you know you're feeling bad, if you know you're in a low state of mind, then, you know, you revisit it, or you talk about it when you see that you're in a higher state of mind and your child's in a higher state of mind. You know, it's a totally different message. You know, you get in the car, you say, oh, you should have done this, you should have done that. Oh, how come you didn't know they were a lefty? You know? But right. But later on, when you're calm, when they're calm, then it's like, hey, you know what? I really love watching you play. But I did notice that, you know, you hit too many slice backhands. That's a different conversation.
Yes, for sure. All right, I'm going to bring another caller on because we've got him lining up and we're running low on time here. So I have a caller from 770. Are you there?
I am here.
Did you have a question or a comment, Ed?
I do have a question for Ed. My name is Preston. My question is, you know, I've really been working on just playing, and I'm having a lot of success with it. And but sometimes when I'm serving, I'll think, you know, I want to try and do maybe a kick serve to the backhand, and I just have that one little thought roll through my head, and then I'll miss that serve, and then the next one. So you know, how much you have to kind of think tactical at times, but how much? When do I know when I'm crossing the line and thinking too much?
That's a great question. You know, tactical is fine, but when you have that thought, you know, you're hitting a second serve, you know, and you think, okay, I'm going to hit a kick serve to the backhand. What if I double fault? There's nothing wrong with that thought if you know that that's normal. You know, the greatest players in the world have that same thought. But the greatest players in the world don't make a big deal of that thought. It just comes and goes, and then it doesn't affect their performance. You know, when you believe a thought, you feel tight. That's when people's feet stop moving. You know, you're not swinging through the ball. When we all have that thought. Tim Mayotte told me that he used to tell himself that he was the worst player in the world when he was in the top 10. And I started laughing at him because you're number 7 in the world, and you miss a couple of shots, and you think you're the worst player in the world. And he believed that thought, and then his play went down. But fortunately for him, he had that thought recognition. He realized pretty quickly that, oh, that was just me, you know, getting in my own head. And then he let it go, and then his play was just fine. So I'm not saying don't think about placement. But the main thing is just playing. You know, can you remember a time when you were in the zone, just playing?
Oh yeah, certainly. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, the game prior, you know, I serve and win, you know, won all 4 points and I'm done. You know, So you know, it's just like weird. It just kind of rears its head in the middle of the game, and then the next time I serve, I'll serve fine. So I'm doing something. I just don't know what it is I'm doing. And it seems like I do it once a minute.
Yeah. I mean, if it's 1 point a match, who cares?
No. One game. It's usually one game a match.
One game. Yeah, it's like a row of dominoes, right? If you want to stop a row of dominoes from falling over, you don't stop it at the last domino. You stop it at the first one. So if you're playing a game and you double fault, you know, that's the first domino, you know, big deal. But if you start thinking into that first point that you lose, and then the next point, you're still thinking about it. And the next point, you know, the snowball gets bigger and bigger, and before you know it, you wasted the game.
Right.
So I think the main takeaway is, it sounds like you're just taking your thoughts too seriously, or you don't know where your feelings are coming from.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yes, that is very helpful, definitely.
Good.
Thanks for
calling. Well, thanks
calling.
For calling.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, we got another one on the line for you, and your popular guy today. This is a call from area code 219. Let's see if I can bring him on. I'm having a little trouble. Okay, there we go. Area code 219, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We sure
yep.
can.
All right. Hey, Ed, it's Dan. How you doing?
Dan, how you doing?
Good. Hey, this topic that I've kind of go along with the parenting and junior tennis players. One of the biggest problems I've seen is like if a junior player misses a shot, the first thing they do is, you know, look over to the parents and, you know, see how the parents react. And I was just kind of wondering if you had any advice on, like, communicating with the parents to let them know that it's okay for your kids to, you know, make mistakes on the court or whatnot.
Dan, what's your role? Are you a coach or are you a parent? Or?
Yes, ma'am. Tennis coach.
Tennis coach. Okay, great.
So, yeah, definitely a great question. The first thing I would have the parents do is listen to the recording of this show or the replay.
Mm-hmm.
But it is sometimes a challenge because the child is looking at the parent because, you know, they don't want to disappoint them, or maybe the parent in the past, you know, has reacted negatively or put pressure. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard a parent say to a player, you know, we traveled all the way here and paid all this money to this tournament. You better get results, you know.
Yeah.
I know if people say that to me, I don't like it. I can't imagine, you know, how kids would feel about that. So, you know, it's like I said earlier, I'm not sure if you caught it, but I said, you know, parents' number one job is to provide love and support. And if they do that, if they leave the coaching to the coach for the most part, you know, then I think the relationship is going to be great. But
mm-hmm.
I think the message is lost because parents, it's not like parents wake up in the morning saying, how can I drive Johnny crazy, you know, on the court. It always comes from a place of love, but the message is lost because all Johnny hears is, you know what, you should have done this. You know what, you should have beaten this person. You could have done this, or, you know, you have much
yeah.
more than that, you know. So I think if the parents kind of check in and see, you know, how their child's reacting and how that message is being, you know, put across and check in with their own state of mind, then I think that's a good start.
Mm-hmm.
And
does that
Dan,
make sense?
Yes.
Dan, I would love to add to you that as a parent, one of the things that I heard that seemed really helpful to me, and maybe you, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to my show with Craig Signorelli a few weeks ago, but when Craig has a kid go to a tournament, he gives the parent specific things to look for during the matches. So the parent has a focus other than whether or not the kid won or lost the point. The parent is looking to count, for example, how many slice backhands the child hit during the match, or how many times
mm-hmm.
they served and volleyed. So as a coach, if you can give us specific tasks that we're responsible for during our children's matches, it,
mm-hmm.
I think, takes some of that stress away from just focusing on point by point, game by game, but rather looking for the intricate details that we're tasked with keeping track of. And so maybe it would help, you know, keep our emotions at bay and help us to stay focused on something that won't, you know, exhibit to our child that we're maybe not happy with the way they hit a particular ball. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And also, you know, it's the beauty of what we're talking about today, the mental game, is that we most of us, 99.9% of us, don't know where our feelings come from. So children, young juniors, think that their parents are making them feel pressure, right?
Yeah.
The parents think that the child is making them feel frustrated. You see what I mean? So in other words, everyone's innocent. Everyone's innocent because all we're doing is, you know, we're thinking and we're experiencing our thinking. You know, if we can just understand that the source of our feelings is not from another person or a situation, it's only from our thinking in the moment, then we just relax and we ease up and you know, everything works out.
Yep.
I have, if you go to at the end of the show, I'm going to talk about my website, and I have a free peak performance course. It's 5 videos. I think that would be really helpful to get a little deeper understanding for parents and players. So look for that later on.
All right, will do.
All right, thanks for calling.
I got one more caller in the queue, and then we're going to shift and go to your website.
Sounds good.
Caller from area code 860, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, who's on the line with us?
This is Jeff. I'm down here in San Antonio, actually, right now. And, you know, I've really read up a lot on Ed's philosophies, and I really tried to incorporate them into my game as far as basketball and really, like, focus on the zone. And I heard Ted Mayotte's talk as well, and how he was almost fearful of getting into that zone, and he would just try to stay where he knew he was playing well. But, you know, once you're in the zone, you're almost unstoppable, you know, and you're awarely unaware of it as it is. But, you know, like I said, I try to incorporate, try to get into that. And what I experienced is that the more I use the philosophies of, you know, of recognition, of thoughts just being clouds, you know, then hit 1, 2, or 3 becomes like 10. But it's only on occasion where I can, like, slowly, like, get into that feel almost of a zone, you know? And I'm really trying to, like, work hard to get into it, like, consistently. So any thoughts or, you know, any, you know, thoughts of mine of how to really work harder or, like, not work harder, but really get into that feel, into that zone feel?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because every athlete has experienced the zone. But for most athletes, it's something that happens randomly and infrequently. And so everyone says, Ed, help me get into the zone. Help me make myself get into the zone. But you can't, you know. But the good news is our natural state is the zone. You know, when you see little kids, they're always in the moment. They're always present. You know, I have a good friend and neighbor. They have a 7-year-old boy, and every time he sees me, he runs up to me, gives me a big hug, and he says, Ed Prickly, because I have like a buzz cut, and he thinks my hair feels prickly. And so he just feels my head for like 15, 20, 30 minutes, and he's just in the moment and engaged, and, you know, he doesn't even need toys, you know. So that's our natural state, but for some reason, as we get older, we block that zone. We block that zone because we start thinking more and believing our thinking, and then we believe what other people say and, you know, things like that. But it's like I said earlier, when you hold a tennis ball underwater, you don't need to do anything to have it rise to the surface. It'll naturally do that. When you're in a slump, when you miss a few shots, you don't have to do anything to get back to the zone. You'll naturally go back towards the zone unless you think into your thinking or you believe your thinking. So it's like Nike said, just do it. If you just play, I guarantee you, you'll be in the zone more often. But if you start analyzing it or intellectualizing or trying to make yourself get into the zone, the quickest way to get yourself out of the zone is to try to make yourself get in the zone. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. So it's sort of
so
like
it's just playing, that's it.
Yeah, play for the fun of the game rather than the analytical.
That's it, and don't
cognitive.
Even try to make yourself... Yeah, don't try to make yourself play for the fun of the game. Just play. I mean, you enjoy the game, right? So just play. It's like I always ask people, do people sing to get to the end of the song? No, of course not. You know, they sing because they enjoy singing. You don't play a game just to get to the end of the game. You know, you enjoy it. So enjoy the process, and you'll be pretty pleased with your results.
That's great advice.
Okay.
All right, we're down to our last few seconds. So before we go off the live broadcast, really quickly, your website
is Ed Tseng, and it's edtseng.com. So I want to make sure everybody has that link, and of course it's going to be on parentingaces.com on our link as well. But so talk a few minutes about what you have available on your website as a resource for tennis parents.
Sure. Well, if you go on my site, there's actually a free peak performance course. It's 5 videos, and you just throw in your email, and you have access to the course, and there's a lot of good stuff on there if you want to get a deeper understanding of the mental game. And I also do trainings with athletes and students and business leaders, you know, helping them really understand the mental game, and it's customized for individuals. So I do Skype sessions, phone sessions, and in-person sessions, and I also speak at conferences, to schools, you know, and organizations and clubs. So a little bit of everything, but you can check it out on my site, and, you know, feel free to contact me with any questions. My email is easy. It's ed@edtseng.com, and my phone number is 609-558-1077. And if you guys are interested in, you know, a training or coaching, I'd be happy to do, you know, a free consultation for any of you and then see if it's a good fit.
That's awesome. Well, you've been fabulous.
And I also have my book, which you can get on my site or on Amazon.
Oh, talk about that a second, too, really quickly, because it's gotten rave reviews, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I'm embarrassed to admit, but it's...
Shame on you.
I know. It's on my short list, I promise.
All right. It's a little outdated now, so I feel a little guilty plugging it, but it's still getting, you know, great reviews, and they're selling it at the U.S. Open every year. I may or may not do a book signing there this year, but I'm actually, now that I think about it, I'm in the process of creating a mental toughness boot camp during the U.S. Open. I might actually do 2 of them in New York City, so if you're interested in that, it's for players, parents, and coaches. Shoot me an email, and I can put you on the list and give you some details. Was written...
Or just pop.
What's that?
I said put me on the list right now.
You got it. So the book was written a few years ago, but it's been read by, you know, a lot of high-level athletes, coaches, parents, even people out of the sports world. And there's a lot of, you know, great quotes and some tips, although, as you know now, I don't give so many tips. It's more about, you know, this deeper understanding. The closest thing to this is the audio CD, The Missing Link, on my website. But I'm working on my next book, so I'll try to expedite the process so there's more resources. But and it's been on Amazon's top 10 for sports psychology, so it's done pretty well. It's a quick read. Bob Ryland, actually, when I met him at the Harlem Tennis Center many years ago, James Blake was there and Justin Gimelstob. I gave Bob a copy of my book, and he went home that night and read the whole thing. So that's a good testimony.
That's fabulous. All right. Well, so when the new book is ready, you'll have to let me know, and you'll come back on the show and update us as to what you've learned since publishing the original one and, you know, what we need to learn. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And again, I feel like I always learn so much from my guests, and, you know, you have opened up a whole new world of thought for me. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. And to my listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to Ed today. Please share the podcast. It'll be on our website later this afternoon, and available on our Facebook and Twitter feeds as well. So please make sure to share with your other tennis parent friends. And, you know, we're all in this together. So if we all make the effort to do a little bit better job in our tennis parenting skills, think how much more pleasant it's going to be to travel to these tournaments and hang out with our fellow parents and fellow players. I just think we have the potential to really make some positive changes here. And it's through learning information such as the stuff that Ed shared with us today that I think we can become better tennis parents. So, again, I encourage you to share his message with your friends and let's all make the effort to do better. Ed, thank you. Everyone else, have a great week. Again, asking for those positive thoughts for my son as he travels overseas later today, and for his mother, who will be stressing out on this end, waiting for that phone call that he's arrived safely. Have a great week, and I'll see y'all next week on Parenting Aces.
Thanks, Lisa. Bye, everyone.